President Trump's new restrictions on asylum seekers go into effect today.
This changes everything for asylum seekers who are arriving at the southern border as of today.
We'll hear what those changes mean for migrants heading north. Also, a nation struggles with a surge in drug-related deaths, and it's not the U.S.
In Scotland, we have economically more challenged areas, so this is also part of the reason that Scotland has higher drug deaths.
Plus, the new Mulan movie and its link to Chinese culture.
I've been aware of Mulan as far as I could remember. She's ubiquitous, really, within China, and generations after generation would have grown up with her story.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Glad you could make it here today. The U.S. and Mexico have been working together to address the migrant crisis, but the Trump administration appears to have caught the Mexican government by surprise. Washington has now changed the rules for people who want to apply for asylum in the U.S.
This changes everything for asylum seekers who are arriving at the southern border as of today.
Kenji Kizuka researches refugee protection for the Human Rights First Group in New York.
So what this will mean is that someone who seeks asylum at a port of entry or after crossing the border won't be eligible for asylum anymore. Asylum seekers under this third country transit rule will be able to apply for some lesser forms of protection, but they would no longer be able to receive asylum.
Explain the difference between the third country transit rule and this agreement that what we currently have with Canada.
So the third country transit rule that the administration announced yesterday and that went into effect today, that differs from a third safe country agreement in that this transit rule is just a ban on asylum. It doesn't send people back to another country like Canada or Mexico or Guatemala where they would be forced to seek asylum there. The transit rule at the moment just denies people the opportunity to seek asylum, but it doesn't return them to another country.
What, in your view, is the problem with expanding the safe third country idea to Mexico and Guatemala, Kenji?
We're concerned about the possibility that the U.S. would attempt to sign an agreement with Mexico and Guatemala, this so-called safe third country agreement, because we don't believe that either country meets the criteria that Congress laid out for those agreements. And what Congress said is that a safe third country has to be one where refugees would not face persecution and where those countries have functioning asylum systems that fairly and fully adjudicate asylum applications. And at the moment, neither Mexico nor Guatemala meet those criteria.
So Guatemala's Congress shut down President Jimmy Morales' attempt to sign on to this agreement. A similar situation in Mexico. The Minister of Foreign Relations there says it would never happen. I'd like to know why not. So let's start with Guatemala.
So in Guatemala, my understanding is that some groups intervened before the president of Guatemala could sign the agreement, arguing that this agreement had to be authorized by the Congress in Guatemala and that it couldn't just be signed by the president. And the Constitutional Court agreed with them that the president of Guatemala didn't have authority to do this on his own. So that's what's really paused any safe third country agreement between the U.S. and Guatemala for the moment, because the Guatemalan Congress seems to be fairly opposed to that possibility.
What about Mexico? Yeah.
Yeah, in Mexico, the situation is probably a little more complicated. Mexico has already basically agreed to a return program through the migrant protection protocols, although they haven't agreed to a safe third country agreement more formally, one that would be on paper, basically. So in essence, asylum seekers are already being returned to Mexico, although they are waiting for a decision on their case in the U.S. And in a safe third country circumstance, they wouldn't have a pending claim in the U.S. But for the migrants who are returned to Mexico, you know, it already feels for them as if they've been returned under a safe third country agreement.
Kenji, what is most concerning to you about all this?
This, to us, is just another attempt by the Trump administration to obliterate the asylum system, to send a message to people who are in danger not to come to the United States, and to punish refugees who have made it here looking for safety.
What do you think needs to happen now?
We're looking forward to court challenges to pause this policy, and we hope that it won't be in effect for long.
Kenji Kizuka researches refugee protection for the nonprofit Human Rights First in New York. Kenji, thank you for your time.
Thanks so much.
Brazil, like the U.S., has a long troubled history with the country's original inhabitants. Brazil tried to address that history when it turned to democracy in the 1980s. A new constitution was written that recognized indigenous land rights. But ever since, there's been an ongoing fight over land. On the ground, that fight has been bitter with many violent confrontations. Things had mostly calmed down in recent years, but then Brazilian voters elected a president who changed the course of things. Here's the world's Rupa Shenoy with more from Boa Vista, Brazil.
Isabel Itikawa remembers the day the Brazilian government came and threw her out of her home, a farm in the Amazon. She says police showed up waving a judicial order.
Eu fui expulsa da minha propriedade, expulsa de uma forma humilhante.
I was expelled from my property, expelled in a humiliating way. Hundreds of police officers arrived at our property with guns in their hands.
That was in 2009. Itikawa's family lost the land in Brazil's northern state of Roraima because a court had upheld a decision to declare it and a larger region the size of Hawaii an indigenous territory. That court decision was a huge win for indigenous people. It followed a vicious battle that began in the 1970s when Brazil's military dictatorship built roads into the Amazon and encouraged people to settle there. After Brazil became a full democracy in 1988, the government and courts took years to decide which areas belonged to the indigenous and which farmers had to move. When Itikawa and her family were evicted, she says they were compensated, but it wasn't enough. She says they always believed that somehow they would get their farm back. And then Jair Bolsonaro was elected.
Our hope has been reborn.
Itikawa believes the Bolsonaro government will allow farmers like her to return and lease land from indigenous people.
Today I have a real president, Jair Messias Bolsonaro. He knows what Brazil needs.
And Bolsonaro has made his feelings on the issue plain. He says indigenous people, who make up 1% of Brazil's population, should not have 12% of the land. He's proposing allowing large-scale mining and farming on reservations.
In 2019, we're going to rip up the indigenous territory. We're going to give all the ranchers guns.
On Bolsonaro's first day in office, he made some bureaucratic moves that allowed farming interests more influence over what happens on indigenous lands. Some indigenous people actually agreed with those moves. After all, they could make money leasing land to ranchers and farmers. But thousands of others marched on the capital, Brasilia, to protest. In late April, they rallied there for 3 days.
Wearing body paint and headdresses, thousands of members of Brazil's indigenous communities marched across Brasilia this week to send a strong message to President Jair Bolsonaro.
It takes half a day's driving to get to the heart of indigenous territory from the nearest big city. A bucket of extra gasoline sloshes in the back of our truck because there isn't any where we're going. About an hour out, it's mostly farmland that looks a lot like the American Midwest. Then the paved road ends and the indigenous territory begins. From the bumpy red dirt road, all you can see is flat Amazonian savanna. The trees and shrubs are dense and low to the ground. Thousands of indigenous people live here and raise cattle or farm. We arrive at an open-air building next to a lake. It's a meeting place where indigenous leaders of different groups get together. There are about 50 men and women gathered. One speaker, Anabel Laurentino Dimas, tells the audience they must remember their history and keep fighting, even if people criticize them for not really being authentically indigenous because they wear Western clothes or use cell phones. Afterward, Dimas tells me his people are facing what Native Americans in the U.S. faced in the 1800s when the U.S. government encouraged the settlement of land west of the Mississippi. Dimas says he's worried something similar is happening right now in Brazil with Bolsonaro as president.
Alguém apoiava. Então, hoje a gente vê a mesma coisa.
Dima cites another Brazilian state, Mato Grosso, where indigenous groups have already allowed farmers and agribusinesses to come in and lease land.
Eles apoiaram, né, o governo. Só que o governo...
Dima says the indigenous there thought it was a good idea, but they ended up poor and living on the streets, he says. But Dimas is worried that if his community doesn't cooperate, the Bolsonaro government may arm farmers who want to reclaim the land. If that happens, Dimas says, there could be a massacre. A missionary I meet here explains why that fear is so real for indigenous people. Gabriel Olu is a Catholic priest from Kenya who's here to preach to both the indigenous and farmers. He says before the government and courts finished the long process of deciding which land should go to indigenous people, it was like a war zone.
Because with the indigenous, some of them, they like fishing and also gathering of the fruits and also hunting. And these farmers, they could not allow them to enter, to pass even their lands. If they pass, some of them were killed or being shot.
Olu says all that may begin again if Bolsonaro keeps encouraging farmers who still want their land back.
But we hope that it will not happen again. And we're expecting this government also to respect the rights of the indigenous as stated in the Constitution. Their rights is respected. There'll be no conflict.
The indigenous appear to have won a first round with Bolsonaro. Last month, Brazil's Supreme Court ruled that the president overstepped his authority in making it easier for farming interests to have influence in indigenous lands. It's a victory for those who protested at the Capitol, like 19-year-old Carla dos Santos. She plans to become a lawyer to defend indigenous rights.
Nature's perfect the way it is. We as indigenous youth, we carry this flag of sustainability. And we're here to carry on the fight our elders began, using the wisdom of our ancestors.
Dos Santos says, especially now, with the threat of global warming, it's important the land has a protector, an advocate. And she says her people are its natural stewards. Isabel Itikawa, the farmer who was evicted a decade ago, remains skeptical. She believes previous liberal governments misguidedly gave indigenous people the land, and then outsiders, like Catholic missionaries, convinced them to reject commercial farming.
Todo brasileiro tem direito de ir e vir. Todo brasileiro tem direito à propriedade.
Every Brazilian has the right to come and go. Every Brazilian has the right to property. Every Brazilian has the right to live in harmony within their country. I will not say that they gave more preference to indigenous people. I would say that they used the Indians as pawns to justify the arbitrary nature of what they are doing with the Brazilian people.
If anyone can make things right, Itikawa says, it's her president, Jair Bolsonaro. For The World, Rupa Shenoy, Boa Vista, Brazil.
Rupa's stories on Brazil continue tomorrow with a look at how public schools there have become a political battleground. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. You know the stereotype, boys are better than girls at math, and that's why more boys and girls enter STEM fields. Well, not only is that not true, girls, research shows, are just as good as boys in math. But according to a new study, it also turns out that girls are even better at reading. And that seems to account for, in large part, girls going into humanities instead of STEM.
They have a comparative advantage for reading, and so they enroll less in math-related fields and careers later on.
Thomas Breda is at the Paris School of Economics. He co-authored the study. Breda looked at test scores from the PISA test. That's an exam taken by more than 300,000 high school students in dozens of countries. The exam tests for math, reading, and science skills. And it also asks students if they plan on going into a math-related field or a humanities-related field. Breda found that more boys and girls want to go into math and science. Fits the stereotype, but why?
We can't explain much when we try to explain it by the gender differences in math. That's because the girls and the boys are about the same level in math.
But things became more clear when he looked at reading, and specifically how well a kid did in reading compared to how they did in math.
Students tend to pursue studies in the fields they are good at. The teachers try to encourage students to do humanities if they are good in reading or literature, and to do more scientific studies, math-related studies if they are good at math. And as if you take a good student in math, if it's a boy, he is very likely to be better in math than in reading. And so he will study in math. And if it's a girl, even if she's very good at math, there is a higher probability that she's even better in reading. And that's gonna be why the girls tend to favor reading.
But how do you know it's gender that explains the difference in career preference? Like, did you control for things like race or cultural expectations? Because it's pretty complicated.
No, so we don't control for everything. What we say is that there is a huge, huge gender gap in this comparative advantage for math with respect to readings. And when you then take students that have the same value for this comparative advantage, you have a much lower gender gap in the choice of studies. Okay, so then from this, we say it's very likely that actually this comparative advantage explains a large part of gender differences in choice of study.
You did not actually follow these teenagers to see which careers they actually went into. You just looked at what they said they wanted to be when they grew up. So how do you know there's really a link between this preference and their career paths?
Yeah, that's one of the weaknesses of the paper. We are French, as you may hear. so we got data on France for which we observe both what students declare they will do, and the next year we actually observe what they've done. So for one country, which is France, we get exactly the same results.
I mean, it's really intriguing research. How do you think educators and parents should use this data?
I think it should be used to raise awareness on how to teach the different fields to boys and girls, make sure you encourage boys to be better at reading, because now boys tend to really lag behind girls in that field. And vice versa, make sure that the girls follow in math and are good at math. The other thing, the other takeaway that is important is that maybe students put too much emphasis on their grades to make their choice of study. I mean, the reason why we look at those problems is that if you choose math at school, then you get better career prospects, better employment prospects, better wages. This is all well documented by statistics. So a large share of the gender wage gap on the labor market is actually due to the fact that the girls do not go as much as the boys into the math-related fields. So maybe one way to avoid this is be clear about those facts when you speak to high school students, so that they know that maybe they shouldn't choose only in terms of their relative abilities in math and humanities, and they should have a clearer view of the career prospects in the different fields. So that would be a way also to make sure that the girls that are good at math don't always choose humanities because they are even better in humanities.
Thomas Breda is a researcher at the Paris School of Economics. He co-authored the study with Clotilde Knapp, showing that girls' comparative advantage in reading might help explain the gender gap in STEM fields. Thanks very much for being with us, Thomas.
You're welcome.
Surgeons in London have successfully separated twin girls who were born conjoined at the head, two-year-old girls Safa and Marwa. Over the past year, the BBC's medical correspondent, Fergus Walsh, was given exclusive access to follow the twin story.
Laid out on a single operating table under surgical drapes are twins Safa and Marwa. The only part of their bodies exposed is where they're joined at the top of their skull, which is one long tube. The girls have never been able to look at each other's faces. Separating them carries major risks, but the team at Great Ormond Street Hospital are convinced it's the right thing to do. Professor David Dunaway is a plastic and reconstructive surgeon.
If we felt that there wasn't a very, very high chance that we could do it safely, we'd be thinking quite carefully about whether we should do it or not.
Despite being joined, both have lively personalities. They were born in Pakistan and have come with their mother, grandfather and uncle to the UK after a donor agreed to pay the medical costs. Great Ormond Street is one of the few hospitals in the world with the expertise to do this surgery.
Yeah, that's good for her.
The separation is so complex, it will be done over three stages. They won't be physically apart until the third operation. Finally, in February this year, the moment all have been waiting for, the day of separation.
So this is Safa's brain, that's Marwa's brain. Yeah. So the sheets should be running like this, like yes. this, and like this.
Eventually, the final Moving connections the are severed and the twins are physically separated.
Fantastic.
Okay, good. Safa is moved next door, okay. each twin now in their own operating theatre.
Okay. Here you go. So, peace for me, peace for you.
The pieces of skull that were removed are shared out. Each chunk is split in two, doubling its surface area. Surgical saws, chisels, glue, along with metal plates and screws, give this the air of a carpenter's workshop. There's just enough bone to cover the top of each girl's head.
Hello, Safa. Hello, Marwa.
Then begins the long road to recovery, which includes daily physiotherapy to help the girls reach some basic milestones, such as learning to sit and roll. Neurosurgeon Oais Jilani.
We made the decision that the bulk of the common vessels go to Marwa, the weaker twin. Because of that decision, Safa suffered a stroke, and she has a weakness in her left arm and left leg. So for me, the big moment's going to be when she walks.
This month, nearly a year after they were admitted, the twins leave hospital. Their mother, Zainab, is delighted at the freedom separation has brought. Safa and Marwa are likely to have learning difficulties, but despite any problems they may yet face, both family and doctors believe it was right to separate the twins and give them a chance of an independent future.
Incredible.
The BBC's Fergus Walsh reporting. You're listening to The World. Before the U.S. put a man on the moon, the Soviets had the lead in the space race.
The Soviet Union has today laid claim to one of the greatest scientific achievements, one of the greatest engineering achievements, and incidentally, one of the most courageous ventures of all time. It has sent a man into space and brought him back alive.
That story, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX.
4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes.
I remember that moment watching on a black and white TV that my dad rented for the occasion. It was a culmination of a 10-year race to the moon that started here. October 1957, an odd, unsettling sound. Americans were disoriented.
Until 2 days ago, that sound had never been heard on this earth. Suddenly, it has become as much a part of 20th century life as the whir of your vacuum cleaner. It's a report from man's farthest frontier, the radio signal transmitted by the Soviet Sputnik, the first man-made satellite as it passed over New York earlier today.
A beach ball-sized metal globe that hurtled through space a couple hundred miles above the United States. Many Americans thought Sputnik might be a prelude to nuclear war. In Moscow, Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev was delighted. Now he had a foothold in outer space and proof of the Soviet Union's technological sophistication. Sergei Khrushchev, Nikita's son and a former Soviet missile engineer, recalls that moment that ignited the space race in Chasing the Moon. It's a PBS documentary series airing tonight.
Really, we did not expect such big reaction of the outside world, especially in the United States. In the Soviet Union, it was just much more modest. On the first information about Sputnik, it was only 100 lines in the Pravda newspaper and other newspapers, nothing else.
The documentary Chasing the Moon does a really good job taking us back to the roots of the U.S.-Soviet space race. And it's post-war Germany. The Nazis had built ballistic missiles capable of space flight. And at the end of the war, the Americans and the Soviets competed to recruit Germany's best rocket engineers and scientists. The Americans won that battle. How did they do that?
In the United States, Werner von Braun became one of the leading engineers in the designing missiles in this country. In the Soviet Union, our rocket engineer and the chief designer, Sergei Korolev, he thinks that he can do it better than Germans. So Germans was in Soviet Union more observers of what the Soviets doing, but not participant of the project.
So let's hear Wernher von Braun, the young engineering prodigy who'd been a member of the Nazi Party and an SS officer. Here he is describing why he wanted to work with U.S. scientists rather than the Soviets.
This decision was essentially not one of expediency, but a moral decision. We knew that we had created an extraordinary new weapon with tremendous potentialities. We had seen Germany in the claws of death, and it was our intention to hand our new weapon over to a nation of whose leaders we felt were governed not by the laws of materialism, but by the laws of Christianity and humanity.
Sergei Khrushchev, I have to ask you, as someone who had been invested in the success of the space race on the Soviet side, Wernher von Braun came to the U.S. space program not 20 years after the end of World War II. How have you come to terms with the fact that the U.S. space program happened in large part because of someone who worked for the Nazis just 20 years earlier?
We thought that he was a great engineer, and we did not think at that time it was morally acceptable or not acceptable. It was part of the war, and we have the separation of the people who committed their duties and the people who initiate all these crimes.
So then, 1961, and the Soviets take another big leap ahead in the race to the moon.
The Soviet Union has today laid claim to one of the greatest scientific achievements, one of the greatest engineering achievements, and incidentally, one of the most courageous ventures of all time. It has sent a man into space and brought him back alive.
That Soviet man in space was Yuri Gagarin. Sergei Khrushchev, your father turned Gagarin's orbit into a huge propaganda coup, didn't he?
It's natural. If it will be American, it will be even more propaganda. But it was a really great achievement. When we met the Gagarin in Moscow on the April 14, it was maybe the same crowds and the same level celebrations we celebrated the victory over the Germany on the May 1945. People were on the street, on the roof of the buildings, in the balconies, in the windows, toward the Red Square.
How old were you?
61. I was 26. I go with my father to the airport. Gagarin reported to my father, and then after that, they sit in this open car going to the Red Square. And my father was very happy to sit in the back seat behind Gagarin and his wife.
So shortly after the Yuri Gagarin space shot, President John F. Kennedy in the United States made his big promise.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
And the unstated goal here, of course, for JFK being beat the Soviets to the moon and do it before the end of the decade. 1970 was the deadline. The mission did not move as fast as JFK wanted. He started to worry about what the space program might mean for his reelection. He actually proposed working with the Soviets to pool resources. What do you think might have changed in the course of world history if the Americans and the Soviets had cooperated in this mission to the moon? If it hadn't been a space race, but a space collaboration?
I think it will save us money. It will beginning of the working together on this very expensive space project, like we worked later with the International Space Station and some other project. It will be good to the us, it will be good for the United States and for the rest of the world.
We know how the story ended. JFK was assassinated, of course, in 1963. Your father was ousted from power the next year. In the U.S., Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon continued JFK's mission, though, and then U.S. astronauts walked on the moon 50 years ago in 1969. When you and your father received the news of that American moonwalk, after all of your own efforts, what sort of emotion or reaction did that stir up for both of you?
After my father, it really began the race, because Brezhnev was ready to invest money and to be the first. And secondly, of course, we were proud that it is a world achievement. It seems that thing that normal Americans were proud when the Soviets first go on the orbit. It was a really great achievement.
Sergei Khrushchev is a former Soviet missile engineer and the son of former Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev. He's one of the key figures in Chasing the Moon, a new documentary from American Experience airing on PBS. Sergei Khrushchev, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
We've posted a photo essay with 12 lesser-known facts from the Apollo mission, like why the U.S. flag on the moon seems to flap without the help of any breeze on the moon. That and more are at theworld.org. When humans first landed on the moon 50 years ago, a lot of people believed it was just the start of human travel far out into the solar system. They assumed that by now there would be settlements on the moon and that Mars and other distant worlds would be within reach. So clearly we're not there yet, but once again, there are plans to reach the moon and beyond, as the BBC science editor Tom Fielden reports.
We leave as we came, and God willing, as we shall return.
Gene Cernan, the last man to set foot on the surface of the moon, bids an emotional farewell on the lunar surface as the crew of Apollo 17 prepare to return to Earth. At the time, and even though the Apollo era was at an end, it was widely assumed we would soon be back.
Rather than lead in space, too often we've chosen to drift.
But that was 47 years ago.
When we drift, we fall behind.
50 years, Vice President Mike Pence reminded members of the National Space Council in March, since that first small step.
In the debate that followed, sending Americans to the moon was treated as a triumph to be remembered, but not repeated.
But now, really for the first time since the Apollo era came to an end, there's a comprehensive plan to go back to the moon and beyond.
We will return American astronauts to the moon, not only to leave behind footprints and flags, but to build the foundation we need to send Americans to Mars and beyond.
That plan is Artemis, aptly named after the twin sister of Apollo and goddess of the moon, and it is much more than a footprints and flags dash. NASA's Stuart McClung.
I like to think of it as an enabler, right? We'll get back to the moon. We will set the stage for even further exploration. And so it's not just get out there. It's get out and use and prove and then build off of that.
And building in space is a key element in the Artemis program. Jennifer Lopez is a former technology lead on the International Space Station and founder of NASA's Datanaut Corp.
The first 3D printer was launched to the space station about 4 or 5 years ago. So starting with that as the baseline and now looking at using a regolith, which is the material on the surface of the moon, and integrating that into these new structures. The long-term goals are to essentially build full habitats or large structures in space.
So if I'm now in control of the robot...
Aiding and abetting humanity as we build our way out into the solar system will be a fleet of robotic and semi-autonomous landers, rovers and scientific instruments and devices.
So it would do exactly the same thing.
At the European Space Agency's Human Robotic Interaction Laboratory near Amsterdam, Thomas Kruger's designing a wearable exoskeleton that could one day control a robotic explorer on the surface of a distant world.
In our scenario, the astronauts orbit the planet, we send the robots down, and the robot would mimic my movement.
You see, so you swing your arm forwards and backwards, you lift up and down, you reach out to pick something up.
Indeed.
And on the planet below, the robot is going to do the same thing.
Yes, it does the same thing.
And because this is no longer a bipolar geopolitical race, he says James Carpenter believes it will be a global effort for all mankind.
There are countries investing, agencies investing, the private sector investing, new rationales emerging. And so right now is really a critical point. It's the point where we as a species become a spacefaring species. It is starting and it's happening now.
James Carpenter there of the European Space Agency speaking with the BBC's Tom Fielden. The United States is in a serious opioid crisis. Across the Atlantic, Scotland is also struggling. Scotland has more drug deaths per capita than any European country by a lot. New data show that drug deaths have surged by more than 25% there. The Scottish government this month created a special task force to confront the problem. Katrina Matheson is chairing that task force. She's an addiction researcher at the University of Stirling.
The problem we've got now is that people are feeling stigmatized and they're falling out of treatment and they're not re-engaging with treatment. I think this plays into some of these figures we're seeing because we have less people in treatment than we do, for example, in England.
I mean, what is the stigma around?
People associate it with crime and just with an unhealthy lifestyle, or that people might consider that they brought it on themselves. That's the kind of line you sometimes hear. But in fact, what we do know is that a lot of people who have problem drug use now have had very challenging childhoods, or who through their upbringing and through their life have suffered all sorts of trauma that makes their condition and their mental health problems all the more complex.
Professor, how many deaths are we talking about here, and why the increase?
The deaths this year have increased to over 1,000. This is the highest level we've ever had. We also have a pattern where people use multiple drugs, benzodiazepines. I don't know if you're familiar with that term, but they're a sedative used for anxiety. But heroin, I would say, is still the main base drug.
And what about prescription opioids? I mean, because we know it's a problem here in the States. Is it affecting any of these numbers at all?
Drug use in Scotland is a little bit different from the picture in the US, where I know you have a lot of problems with prescription opioid use. I know fentanyl was an issue in the US. We don't have the same level of fentanyl in our drug-related death figures, thankfully. So it is a different picture, I would say. Part of our drug problem started back in the 1980s, and we had problems post deindustrialised parts of the country where unemployment was high. And a group of people at that time became addicted to heroin. And that group is now ageing and in their 40s. Basically, they're physiologically compromised, and that makes it far more challenging for them when they do take combinations of drugs.
So now that the task force has been created, just created, what's the next step? What do you hope to get done and when?
Well, we're going to be meeting regularly. Our first meeting will probably be in a month or so's time. It's not just going to be a talking shop and then a series of recommendations at the end. We will look at the evidence on an ongoing basis across different areas, so as health and criminal justice and policing, and whether there's alternatives to, you know, prison, for example. So and we'll be testing innovations in practice, and where those work, we'll roll that out.
Katrina Matheson, an addiction researcher at the University of Stirling and chair of the new Drug Task Force to Reduce Drug Deaths in Scotland. Katrina, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mulan will be back on the big screen soon. The new version of the film comes out next spring. Disney is behind the new Mulan. They're hoping things go better this time. Disney also produced the 1998 animated version of the movie, and it did not go over well in China. So this time the heroine will not be animated with an abnormally thin waist and batting eyes. Mulan 2020 is live action. It features well-known Chinese actors. The story is timely in its gender-bending. It's about a teenager in ancient China who pretends to be a man to fight off invaders and save her family, which she does very well. Thank you very much.
It is my duty to fight.
Shui Ting, Christine Ni, writes and speaks about Chinese culture, mostly to a Western audience. Shui Ting, when I look at the trailer, this teaser trailer for the new Mulan, I see all kinds of messages. There's female empowerment, a celebration of Chinese culture writ large, acrobatics that will remind audiences of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. What do you see?
I see a lot of things, too. Whilst I can see a lot of the tropes in the original animation that the Disney film is returning to, is trying to do a lot of different things from these tropes and trying to pay tribute to the original source material.
Yeah, I think it'd be worthwhile if you explain to us what the original Chinese legend of Mulan is about.
So the legend of Mulan originated from a ballad written around 5th or 6th century. It's about the northern borders of China being threatened by tribes who are trying to invade China. And there was a conscription that required one male member of each household to go to war. And Mulan actually has a younger brother in the original story. And the plot is that her father is very elderly and the younger brother is too young, which is what prompted Mulan to disguise herself as a boy and to go to war.
So how much does it matter to you and getting people to understand Chinese culture that Disney maintain the original legend of Mulan as closely as possible, you know, keep it as authentic as possible?
I think that considering how the film industry and the film market, the global film market has changed for Disney, 20 years ago, 30% of its profits were from overseas, and now it's 70%.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a massive jump. Yes. I mean, the Chinese love Disney, and they're going through a golden age in cinema right now, the Chinese. Unlike a lot of places in the rest of the world where people are struggling to get cinema goers into the screens, with the rise of multiplexes all around the cities of China, it's actually a very good time for the cinema industry in China at the moment. And also box office takings from China can really influence how a film performs internationally.
I mean, it's interesting. When Mulan came out, the animated version in 1998, that's about the time, you say, when Hollywood was only banking about 30% on China for its revenue.
Yeah.
And Mulan in 98, the animated version was a flop. Why was that?
Well, to me, why it flopped with the Chinese is that you have a major Western studio telling them about their own story in a completely non-Chinese way. It was Chinese in a very stereotypical manner, in that it had fireworks, it had lanterns, it even had a panda in there, but none of it really felt right. The story of Mulan is a story about familial honor and duty, whereas the film presents Mulan as a character that pursues self-realization. It's sort of presenting something that is meant to be Chinese to the Chinese, but it's not actually very close to their culture.
So at least from this trailer tease, do you see a conscious attempt by Disney to kind of pivot out of the troublesome aspects of the animated version and really appeal to a Chinese audience?
I think it does. I think the presentation of the film as a martial arts epic, and also presentation of Mulan as someone who's sort of very Chinese in that she's sort of a stoic character who is very aware of her duty to her family. There is certainly an epic side to her story, because according to the original legend, she didn't just go to war for a few months or, you know, a year or two. She went and lived in the borders for over a decade.
Wow.
In very harsh conditions, and fought very long, bloody battles.
Chinese audiences are not unused to, then, different treatments of the Mulan legend.
No, not at all. I was born in China myself, and I spent a childhood there before coming to the UK. And I've been aware of Mulan as far as I could remember. She's ubiquitous, really, within China. And generations after generation would have grown up with her story. But she's very much presented as this patriotic soldier who is bringing honor to her family and her country. Whilst family is still paramount in Chinese culture even today, I think that the Chinese need to find their own ideas of what she's a symbol of.
Shui Ting, it's expected that this new Mulan is going to do crazy big box office in China. What kind of road will that pay for other releases in China? And how closely do you think Hollywood is paying attention to Chinese reaction?
The Chinese audiences have already been very receptive to Hollywood films for decades now, since China joined the World Trade Organization in 2001 and basically opened its film market up to international competition. However, recently, some domestic films excelled Hollywood films in the box office takings. So I think major Western studios are finding that they have more competition against domestic Chinese titles.
Shui Ting, Christine Ni writes for a global audience about Chinese culture and civilization. Christine, thanks very much for speaking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Harlech, North Wales, a town that recently earned a new title, home to the Guinness World Record for steepest street in the world. Locals know the struggle of walking up Fort Penfleth to reach the pharmacy, post office, and other shops at the top of the hill.
You know, I can remember as a little girl walking up this road every Sunday to Sunday school. A little lady from our street called Blod used to bring us up, and she did the same for many generations. It's very much part of our culture here.
That's Sarah Baden. She's helped organize the effort to get the street officially recognized for its record-breaking 37.45% incline. Now she's one of the residents of Harlech, celebrating their victory over the previous record holder, a street in New Zealand with a mere 35% incline. Pshaw.
Oh, we're absolutely elated and exhausted, of course, after the hard work over the last year.
Over in Dunedin, New Zealand, writer Hamish McNeely is a bit disappointed that Baldwin Street there no longer wins this street fight. Yeah, pun intended. But he does have a warning.
It's just a constant stream of tourists going there. I talked to a lady today who often has tourists wandering around her house, taking photographs inside, all around her garden. People think it's like some sort of Disneyland attraction.
You've been warned, Harlech, but congratulations anyway, on having officially the steepest street in the world. And that's our show for this Tuesday. The world's theme music is by Ned Porter. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.